My guest Leila Ahmed is the first professor of women's studies in religion at Harvard Divinity School. She's also the author of the book Women and Gender in Islam. In her memoir, A Border Passage from Cairo to America, she writes about being a Muslim and feminist. She was born in Cairo in 1940 and grew up in an educated, prosperous family. Her parents sent her to English-speaking schools in Egypt and to college in England. Her father chaired the Nile Water Control Board. After the revolution in 1952, when Nasser assumed power, her family's status changed. Nasser decided to go forward with the Aswan Dam, which her father opposed for environmental reasons. As a result, he lost his job and was censored. Soon after, her family's values were no longer considered in sync with Egypt, which had begun to turn against the West. Ahmed says her Western education began to be considered suspect. She became embarrassed to speak English. I asked her about the early expressions of extremism she saw in Egypt in the 1950s.
It was mostly in the form of Arab nationalism. We began to be kind of bludgeoned by the notion that we were Arab. And this came as a bit of a surprise. Well, retrospectively, I know it was a surprise to me, but I didn't quite understand it then, because I had grown up understanding that we were Egyptian, and now to be Arab was somehow more true and more important. And by reading history, I came to understand that to be Egyptian meant to be multi-religious and multi-ethnic. That was the kind of country they were trying to construct at that point in history. So the insistence was that Copts and Muslims and Jews and the people who made up the population of Egypt, in fact, at that point, were all Egyptian. And so the pluralism of Egypt was enormously emphasized. Whereas once we became Arab, which happened in 52 with Nasser's revolution, being Arab, being tied to the Arab nations became paramount. Our identity as Arabs, and implicitly but not explicitly as Muslims, was paramount. And so people who were not Arab or Muslim in some sense, in other words, the Copts of Egypt and the Jews of Egypt, were not quite part of the identity. And I think it's not coincidence that this followed the war with Israel in 48, and it was a redefining of the identity of Egyptians to fit an anti-Israeli stance and a pro-Arab, pro-Palestinian stance.
Did you have friends who were changing, friends who were starting to practice a more radical form of Islam, or friends who were becoming Arab extremists?
No, I didn't, actually. Much later, I would have friends who would join, relatives and friends, actually, who would not, I wouldn't say would join fundamentalism, but, for instance, they started wearing the hijab, you know, the headscarf, the Muslim headscarf. I don't think they became fundamentalists in any sense of violent people, but they or even extremists, but they came to believe that that is what Islam required of them.
And were you able to understand that? It's obviously something that you did not believe.
No, well, I mean, it's what I study, you know. So no, I do have to understand it, and thank goodness I think I am able to understand it. It's, I mean, I hear it now from many of my students who might wear scarf or hijab, and they do so obviously. Essentially because they believe that the Quran or Islam requires that, but also because among their critiques is that people of my generation accepted the Western notion of the veil as oppressive, and that in fact Western dress, miniskirts, corsets, high heels, all of those things are actually much more damaging and at least the sexist. So I do understand, and I think their critique sometimes makes sense.
What kind of Islam were you brought up with?
How do I speak of this? It was, the easiest way to speak of it. It was a very kind of mystical, personal sense of Islam, a very pacifist kind of Islam, that really was based on. I mean, I use the term in my memoir that it is a women's Islam, but women is in quotes, because I think it's the Islam of the non-highly literate people. It's an Islam that's based not on studying books and texts, but on just listening to the Quran. And, of course, there is a huge tradition, and it's a very old tradition, of the Quran being above all an oral text, a text that you listen to, listen to the recitation, and the and recitation can be very beautiful. And if you listen to it, what remains at the end is really its recurring themes, and its and these are inescapably its emphasis on peace and justice and mercy and compassion and those kinds of things. So, and I think that's what ordinary people take away from it, and feel that this is how these are the qualities that should be pervading their lives. So I think that's the Islam is the Islam that I grew up believing to be Islam.
My guest is Leila Ahmed, author of the memoir A Border Passage from Cairo to America, A Woman's Journey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Leila Ahmed, the first professor of women's studies and religion at Harvard Divinity School. She writes about growing up in Egypt and being a Muslim and feminist in her memoir, A Border Passage.
In your memoir, you write that there was a period when you were craving religious faith and you were considering converting from Islam to Christianity. Why were you considering conversion?
It was a time of enormous both loss and difficulty for me, and I didn't quite know where to turn. You know, I grew up in a place where I don't know how to describe it exactly. Faith wasn't something that you practice. It was just there in the air, you know, so that if some tragedy befell people, everyone around you would be thinking about it in what now I would call religious terms, in that they would think about it as, I think the basic issue is that their attitude was that life was meaningful, and somehow this had something to do with God. So when things happened, then you reflected on what happened, and it was within a context which gave meaning to all of life. And when I was in England, I was without this community, of course, and it was also a very secular world in which the assumption was that anyone who believed in God was really not quite as smart as people who didn't. And then when I went through, I lost both my parents and my own health was uncertain. I really felt a total loss and deeply needed something that acknowledged meaning as actually central to life. So I think that was what it was about.
Yet you didn't convert.
I didn't convert, no.
What did you think would change for you if you did convert from Islam to Christianity? What did you, at that time in your life, think you might find in Christianity that you weren't finding in Islam?
A feeling of total faith. And I guess at that point, it must mean that I wasn't able to find it. And I thought perhaps... But you know, I'm hesitating as I'm answering you, because what I understand now is also that I was living in a country where there were very few people who were Muslim or anything else other than Christian, actually. And of course, I'd grown up in a colonial situation in which what white people did and what perhaps Christians did was implicitly superior. So maybe that was an element of why I went through that crisis.
Do you consider yourself observant of of the Islamic faith. I'm asking that because I've met many religion scholars over the years who are deeply committed to spending their lives immersed in religion, but more immersed in studying its history than in actually practicing it, because they've had problems with organized religion and problems with the way the religion has been interpreted. But they want to spend their lives immersed in thinking about religion, if not in actually observing and practicing it.
Part of what I do when I hear things, sometimes I translate them in my mind and imagine myself asking my mother this or my grandmother. And neither of them would even understand the question, because to be Muslim, what that meant was a way of being. It didn't mean I necessarily believe in this or that exactly, but it means I live in this way and I have these values. So it's not exactly translatable as observant or practicing. It's about something much more diffuse and much more embodied than a belief, which is a very intellectual thing.
You write in your memoir that there are large numbers of Muslims who have never lived in a land in which freedom of thought and religion were the accepted norm. And the way in which that's changed now, you say, is that tens of thousands of Muslims are living in Europe and in the United States, where there is freedom of thought and religion. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, and what impact you think it's had on Islam to have so many Islamic countries run by dictators.
Well, it's had a huge impact, but not only by dictators, because dictators is a modern term, but I mean throughout history, what religion means, what Islam means, has been constructed in a particular way, and it's connected with state power and the power to dictate what people are supposed to believe. And if you don't, you're in very serious trouble. So it goes all the way back, and it, of course, runs into the present day. Many of the Sufi thinkers, for example, were considered heretical. Some were executed. So it's a very fundamental thing that that people have done without. And I guess that partly relates to the whole issue of practice in a way, because practicing or being observant implies somehow some public demonstration or public way of being religious, whereas I think for many Muslims, how you feel about your religion is a very private matter because the state has been so tyrannical. So to finally be able to actually write and speak about what you believe is a huge, huge thing which we haven't entirely crossed yet, because we know of Muslim writers who get threatened for saying what they think, you know.
Leila Ahmed is the author of A Border Passage from Cairo to America, A Woman's Journey. She's a professor of women's studies and religion at Harvard Divinity School.